This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, Secretary Condoleezza Rice calls for a Middle East summit, and the government digs through Americans' financial records to fight terrorism. Now, should it? Joining us today is Michael Myers, Executive Director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, also Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, and Glenn Lowry, Professor of both Social Sciences and Economics at Brown University. So thanks for being with us, and let's move along to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. She announced she's going to attend this three-way summit with Israel and Palestinian leaders in the coming weeks. She wants to boost Mideast peace efforts and help establish a Palestinian state. At a press conference recently, Secretary Rice said the president has had the two-state plan in place for himself since 2001.
I have heard loud and clear the call for deeper American engagement in these processes. The United States is absolutely committed to helping to find a solution where Israelis and Palestinians can live in security, in which they can live in peace, and in which they can live in democracy.
Laura, this is an issue that has existed for a long time, but it has kind of taken a back seat to what is being called the war on terror. Is it important for the U.S. to engage as, again, language that got used many times in the past, an honest broker between Israel and Palestine?
Absolutely, it's important for I am glad that Condi Rice and the Bush administration finally remembered they do have a major conflict in the Middle East that goes beyond Iraq. And I think that's the problem. The so-called roadmap that was supposed to lead to truce in the Middle East and for lasting peace has really gone off the road. All eyes have been on Iraq for the last several years. As a matter of fact, Condi Rice recently decided to refocus her energies, her personal energies on this issue, maybe because it seems a lot easier to deal with this one than to deal with the Iraq mess. But there's a lot of political obstacles to her moving ahead with the two players in this. Both Israel and the Palestinians really don't have the political capital right now in their own constituencies to be able to make any promises or make any commitments. Right now, the Arab world is looking, you know, for some serious progress in Iraq, and of course they're very skeptical about it, and that would include the Palestinians. And we just heard that Israel is moving ahead, building new housing for Jewish settlers on the West Bank, something that they had committed to not doing as part of this peace process. So it's really questionable if she's going to really be able to make any inroads here.
Glenn, what's going on, do you think, in terms of strategy for the United States? Is it that the U.S. has become extremely committed in Iraq and wants to turn to a different diplomatic page? Is this a passion of Condoleezza Rice's? Why do you think this is happening now?
Well, I think that the diplomatic card has to be played some kind of way. Now, the Iraq Study Group was explicit in suggesting that discussions with Syria and Iran were called for, and the Bush administration has been explicit in rejecting that suggestion. But they have to do something. There's been a lot of complaining about the fact that the administration has been on the sidelines in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict since the inception of the Bush administration. And that war last summer between Israel and the Hezbollah in Lebanon, in which entire Shia villages in the south of Lebanon were wiped out by Israeli bombardment, and in which densely populated urban neighborhoods in the center of Beirut were obliterated by Israeli bombardment with American weapons, left millions of Arabs throughout the region extremely angry with the position that the United States and Israel have taken. So I think the diplomatic stakes here are an effort for the United States to communicate to people whose assistance we need to resolve the mess in Iraq that we are, in fact, an honest broker, that we do, in fact, see both sides of the question, that we will stand up for what we have asked the Israelis, our allies, not to do, which they insist on doing, and that we'll get busy with that. That's what I think is going on.
Michael, how important is it for the U.S. to act diplomatically between Israel and Palestinians in order to reflect, as Glenn has kind of hinted, on the larger issues in the whole region?
Well, first you have to realize and recognize that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not taking a backseat to the war on terror, that it is an integral part of the discussion, the analysis of the war on terror. Israel has lived with terror. Israel is an oasis in a desert, quite frankly. And you have a situation where it's three-way summit, you know, when you exclude Syria, you exclude Iran from the discussions, I don't know if a three-way summit is going to be diplomatically effective, because we've seen in the recent past that both the Israeli and the Palestinian leaders have not been able to deliver. So how do you keep focus? How do you advance peace in the Middle East when you have the context of an Iraq-Iran theater, nuclear proliferation threat from Iran? You have the context of a recent conference of Holocaust denial, a refusal on the part of the Palestinian militants to recognize the right of Israel to exist as a state. You have Israel's isolation in that theater, and the mounting drumbeat from its critics and its enemies about expansionism. And you have the Lebanon theater and the Hezbollah situation. So how does Secretary Rice, and for that matter, President Bush, keep focus in a situation where they have failed to be an honest broker as an international force, and have failed miserably in terms of getting people to the table and not having a military response such as they have had in Iraq?
Well, we're going to keep an eye on this, but since we've brought up the issue of terrorism, I want to transition us to another topic closer to home. The U.S. government is sifting through citizens' financial past, oh, heaven help me, to prevent future terrorist attacks.
You're going to need more than heaven's help.
Yeah, exactly. Federal intelligence and law enforcement agencies are using the IRS and other sources of personal financial information to search for leads in terrorism investigations. Vice President Dick Cheney defends the method as a perfectly legitimate activity. Now, I don't know, Glenn, what do you think about all this? I mean, one might argue that probably it has already happened in the past, and now we're just talking about it.
Well, you know, one of the problems here is that you never know just how crucial this kind of information is for the security problems that we face. We face real security problems. I mean, the hypotheticals, you know, we had to do this or else somebody was going to set off a biological weapon in the center of New York and 1 million people were going to die, scare the bejesus out of all of us, and we want to say, yeah. But the thing that I'd like to emphasize here is that, you know, this is like a ratchet. It only goes up. When you expand the government's powers to inquire, to gather information, to track, to collate, to observe, to scrutinize, those powers don't go down later after the emergency has disappeared. And we really need to think about what kind of state we want to have and what kind of relationship between law enforcement and our citizens we want to have. The Constitution, unfortunately, doesn't cover every detail. There's a lot of room for discretion. So, you know, right now we're looking for terrorists, but tomorrow it's going to be somebody who hired an illegal alien off the books or who didn't pay their parking tickets or someone who's delinquent in their student loans or their child support payments. And the government will be using financial surveillance to track down these bad guys. And I'm not sure we want to live in a situation like that.
Well, Michael, it's also a question of what is considered financially dodgy. I mean, I think going out and buying a bunch of explosives, okay, that could be considered very dodgy. But when there was the whole debate over surveillance of library records, if you get a book about terrorism, does that mean that you want to know more about it in an academic sense, or do you want to know more about it in a dangerous sense? That's where, do you think that the government is prepared to make those kinds of decisions?
The government has made those decisions, and the government has made those incursions on civil liberties. That's what the government's doing. We're in a constant state of emergency. And we are living in a global society where there is, the constant threat of terrorism, and there is a national security exception to privacy. And when there is a national security exception to privacy on the part of the government, then as the government's concerned, there is no such thing as an absolute right of privacy, and our own privacy zones shrink. Government will assert the justification to open our mail, and they have, to look into our library records, and they have, to use data mining techniques to cross-reference and cross-check our associations, and they have, to cross-check our tax returns, our financial records, our donors, our gifts to people to whom we make gifts, and for what purpose. They will do this. The question is, how do you monitor? How do you regulate? How do you control this governmental surveillance? With what checks, with what balances, with what judicial review? The government is now even asserting there's no need for judicial review. There's no need for a warrant. And the congressional oversight, the people's chamber, has collapsed because, you know, in the interest, as Glenn says, of national security and emergency and the fight against terrorism, we now have increased techniques for airport security. We have terrorist watch lists with name confusion. We have government and foundations putting restrictions on their grantees. We have banks who are handing over its customers' records to the government, even without a warrant or even notice to the customers. The civil liberties climate here, the cause is extraordinarily challenged, if not compromised, with the instinct of Congress, the people's chamber, to be quote-unquote patriotic and to sign off on such things as the USA Patriot Act without even reading what they're authorizing government to do.
All right. Well, I want to go to Laura, but first, if you're just tuning in, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We were just listening to Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, talking about some new plans to look into Americans' financial records for anti-terrorism reasons. Also talking to Glenn Lowry, professor of the social sciences and economics at Brown University, and with Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist. Laura, it strikes me that a lot of what already has happened with privacy has to deal with what's in the private sphere, meaning this is a government action, but we voluntarily give up so much information every time we use a credit card, anytime we do almost any of these transactions, and these two worlds of what's public and what's private in the sense of public government and private industry are being merged.
Well, of course. But, you know, we've already had so much information that's available either free or for very little cost on the because of the rise of the Internet. You can go out and buy or acquire for free a Social Security number, bank statements, all kinds of information. So the stuff is already there. I think the thing that concerns me is that we in some ways just sort of have to take the government's word for it. As Michael points out, there's not enough regulation here. There's not enough independent oversight. Dick Cheney was on a talk show the other day saying, you know, we have the right to do this. This is not illegal. And if you don't like us, sue us. Well, that's not really a very comforting response to a government that really does not have much in the way of controls. You don't know whether or not this information is being acquired for legitimate reasons, and you're not going to know because, as Glenn points out, they'll say it's because of a terrorist threat, or they'll say that they may have averted some terrorist threat by acquiring these records, but because they can't talk about the specifics of that, all you know is that they're catching tax cheaters, and all you know is that they're catching people who didn't pay their parking tickets, and it doesn't create any confidence. I think we're already over that level of ratchet that Glenn is talking about, and we have to assume that nothing we are doing in our personal or public lives is confidential at this point.
And when Cheney says nothing. Sue us, that, and when Cheney says sue us, like they're confident they have the Supreme Court to back them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a good point. May I just also say, you know, we could experience another attack. Heaven forbid. God forbid. It could happen. We have to take into account, you know, where the thing is going to go. So the ratchet is a very serious metaphor because, you know, if something happens, it's only going to get worse, more intrusive, more, contrary to our freedoms and our liberties. And I think we are in a delicate situation.
All right. Well, again, we're going to leave that topic there, but it's one we've got to come back to. But there's something we got to talk about today because it happened last night and it was a big deal for Black America. Some call it a precursor to the Oscars, the Golden Globes. You got The Last King of Scotland, Forrest Whitaker winning for Best Actor, Eddie Murphy and Jennifer Hudson of Dreamgirls taking away Best Supporting Actor and Actress prizes. Now, do you think that this is a harbinger for better roles and more roles for African Americans to come? Laura?
Well, don't forget, too, Farai, about Ugly Betty, the Latino-based show, which also won an honor. I think it's symbolically, it's a good thing. It shows that there's a lot of obvious talent there. I don't think that that's where the issue is. I know that the NAACP has made a big issue of this for years, you know, how many big roles are going to people of color in Hollywood and how many awards are being won. I think that's nice for the imagery, but it doesn't really have that much to do with increasing diversity in this country.
So you're thinking of diversity even in the film world, behind the scenes, isn't going to be affected as much by...
It's the big stars. Those are the folks you see holding those Golden Globes in their hands. It's the Hollywood elite. And, you know, I know that Eddie Murphy was very happy to be, and he said last night, he was very happy to be included. But these folks are already as part of the elite. What I want to know is what are they doing to ensure and demand that there's African American and people of color who are writers, who are producers, who are, you know, building the sets. And I think that so much of those decisions are still controlled by the Hollywood machine, which none of us, certainly not black folks, have much to say about.
Well, this is Michael Myers. This last night was a big night for minorities. You know, Jennifer Hudson and America Ferrera from Ugly Betty and the show Ugly Betty.
I just have to say, I adore America. She is.
And Sasha Cohen. It was a big night for minorities.
You going to include Sasha?
Yes, I am. behind, and it was a big night for minorities behind and before the camera. But, you know, I'm not interested, by the way, in negritude. And I just disfavor it. And what I especially disfavor, as much as I do negritude, is self-adulation and self-congratulatory awards shows. So it was a night for characters. Forrest Whitaker needed a script, it seemed to me. He thanked everyone except Idi Amin, the despot that he portrayed.
Oh, come on, Michael. Everybody did that. He was
Michael, you just asked you didn't get a gift bag. All right.
I despise those self-congratulatory, self-adulatory.
We got to let Glenn get his last word because we're almost out of time.
Well, you know, it ain't the Hollywood of 25 or 50 years ago, that's for sure. Yes, minorities, African-Americans, and other folk, too, are more included than we used to be. Yes, there's a big influence of our most talented entertainers in the performing arts and so forth. And this is not just in the United States. This is an impact around the world. So this is certainly something that African-Americans can be proud of. On the other hand, as Laura points out, you know, the serious problems on the ground, and I could list them, but I'd bore your listeners, are not moved one iota by this. So let's keep it in perspective.
All right. Keeping it in perspective, Glenn Lowry, professor of the social sciences and economics at Brown University, Glenn at WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island, Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition.
Keeping
Thank you
real.
All so much. That's right. Keeping it real and keeping it moving.
Thank you.
Take care. Thank you.